Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing spy scandal, which is irritating US-German relations, prompting the Germans to kick out the CIA's top spy in Germany in response to a refusal by Washington to cooperate with German inquiries into US intelligence activities. Andre Markowitz, a professor of comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan, who studies German politics, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, and the European left and the European right, joins us to discuss why the Germans are so riled up over the CIA recruiting two of their spies and how the scandal is impacting dealings with Russia and Ukraine, where the two allies already do not see eye to eye. Then we'll go to El Salvador and speak with Elizabeth Kennedy, an activist scholar who works as a Fulbright Fellow with returned child and youth migrants from the United States in El Salvador, where she currently assists Salvadorans fleeing from gang violence. We will discuss El Salvador's gang problem, which has its roots in Southern California, where the two main gangs, MS-13 and Barrio 18, were formed, and refute the myths that coyotes and imaginary billboards are encouraging the children of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to migrate to the U.S. Then finally, we will speak with Tom Wong, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, who is the creator of the 2013 Center for Investigative Reporting blog on how members of Congress view immigration reform. He joins us to discuss political grandstanding in the face of a humanitarian crisis, and his article at the Center for American Progress, Statistical Analysis Shows That Violence, Not Deferred Action, is Behind the Surge of Unaccompanied Children Crossing the Border. And joining us now is Andre Markowitz, who is the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He has written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right, and the European left. His books include Uncouth Nation, Why Europe Dislikes America, Offside, Soccer, and American Exceptionalism. And his latest book is Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andre Markowitz.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And I'd love to talk to you about the World Cup, of course.
Exactly.
It's almost inescapable. But let's deal with the headlines at the moment, and that is the expulsion of a CIA officer from Germany in response to the revelations that two members of, the BND, the German Intelligence Service, had been recruited by the CIA. And this, of course, comes in the aftermath of the Edward Snowden leaks, the tapping of Angela Merkel's phone. This all feels like a self-inflicted wound. Why is it, though, that Germany is more outraged than, say, France is?
First of all, you're totally right. It is partly self-inflicted, and it's actually also stupid. If there's one person who is the most pro-American and reliable leader in Europe whom one never needs to bug, is Angela Merkel. And to do that just shows you a kind of a complete callousness and stupidity, apart from it being unethical. But that's a different story. Your question, I think, is a very important one, and it has everything to do with Germany's view of itself, its role in history, its the aftermath of the Holocaust, World War II, all this. France basically understands that's what big players do. They're well known that they're all over the United States trying to, spy on all kinds of economic and sort of especially industrial stuff here. And, the Chinese do it. This is what big boys, even not such big boys, do. And it's kind of normal state behavior. In Germany, this is a very different dimension. First of all, in its own history, because obviously snooping has always been associated, above all, with the Stasi. There's always, in the New York Times, there was an equation or sort of making it also the Nazis and the Stasi. And about the Nazis, I could talk to you a lot more that the Germans would not be so upset, but certainly the Stasi. And it's seen as a kind of an excessive form of state power, which the Germans in general are very wary about, much more than the French. The French and the British, they Snowden this, Snowden that, fine, let's move on. And to the Germans, this is also a form of infantilization. It's a kind of that the Americans are not quite trusting us. We're not their equal. They still, it's in the same context that Helmut Kohl was so upset and crying, literally crying at in President Reagan's room in 1984 when he was excluded from the D-Day celebrations, meaning that Germany was sort of never quite sees itself as being really part of the alliance in an emotional way. And this just hits hard, very hard, because it basically says, all of these things, it's overdetermined. A, they are much more worried about what states do in general, what to the French is just normal, and to the Brits and to everyone else. Second, it's also a kind of a form of that we're not really trusted, and we're not really still part of the Western alliance or whatever. And above all, it's also we're not, and in some level, they're not, with this the Anglo-American world of the Five Eyes, who actually don't spy on each other, or at least have that pact, whether we don't spy on New Zealand or Australia doesn't spy on Canada or us, I have no idea. But anyway, at least we purportedly say that we don't. That is seen as an inner circle, which the Germans want to be in, and we don't grant them that. And this is really irksome to them on a lot of dimensions. So I would say that's basically the background to what happened now with these with the BND thing. It's bad. It's kind of it creates another form of tension. And above all, what I find so horrible is that President Obama, when he called Angela Merkel, apparently knew nothing about this, nothing, zero. And that's a problem because, you would suppose that, this basically, I think, says in some ways that the American state is not totally in charge of everything it does. And that's, I would say, again, an issue.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrei Markowitz, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He has written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right, and the European left. And his books include Uncouth Nation, Why Europe Dislikes America, Offside Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and his latest book is Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. Now, the Five Eyes program that you mentioned, the Five Eyes are the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Of course, it is an Anglo-Saxon cabal, if you will, that has an agreement not to spy on each other. They also have another agreement called Echelon, where they, the Canadians get to spy on Americans to avoid U.S. law. The Americans get to spy on Canada and so forth. There's a reciprocal agreement. And as you mentioned, Germany, after the Snowden revelations, asked to join that regime and they were rebuffed. So apart from this, the outrage that the president didn't know about it, when we've certainly seen that movie before about rogue intelligence. But is there any sense then that Germany has in this, that what governs this attitude, if you will, on the part of the Americans is that the German relationship is a settled one. They don't have to nurture it. They don't have to bother with it. And therefore, it's sort of has led to this?
It may be that. It's also a form of, again, as I said before, it's basically a form of, it bespeaks a form of inequality to them. And it's basically a form of infantilization and not trusting and not being part of being the big boys, although the Germans could very well argue that on many, many levels, they're many much better allies than the the Brits or whatever, or their more important allies, given, for example, the situation in Europe. And but it has nothing to do with sort of concrete issues. It has something to do, and what is so powerful in politics is the symbolic dimension and how you feel. And they really feel sort of not being equal to the Brits and the Canadians, and I would say even also not to the French, precisely because they see the role of states and how politics is enacted in a much less pragmatic and much more kind of value-laden and moralistic term, and because of their history. Again, some of it I think is also immensely convenient, but that's a different story. So I don't find that states spy on each other particularly troublesome, or that's what they do. And I don't particularly find it weird that allies spy on each other. That's fine too. What I mind especially was, again, the stupidity of the spying. And that ultimately this also has a certain form of backlash that, might have effects down the line where the Germans might actually withhold stuff, or who knows. So it's just, it's a form of stupidity, but it's also part of, the German makeup in this. And I think one has to really analyze it in that context.
Well, Andrei Markovits, back during the Iraq War, and particularly the key build-up to the Iraq War, was Secretary of State Colin Powell's address to the United Nations.
Right.
I spoke with Tyler Drumheller, who was a CIA official in charge of Europe, and he was dealing with the BND, and it was the BND, the German intelligence, that provided them with the information about this guy called Curveball, who was the Iraqi who supplied all of this information about biological weapons and stuff.
Right, right.
And the BND people had warned their American colleague, Tyler Drumhill, that this guy was unreliable. He was an alcoholic and spinning tails, etc. So Drumhill goes to the head of the CIA, George Tenet, and says, for God's sake, this guy's unreliable. And, of course, that didn't stop Tenet from feeding all this nonsense to Colin Powell. And Powell says to this day it was the worst thing that he ever did. Was swallowing that nonsense.
Absolutely. Let me also add another dimension that kind of plays into this, namely clearly 9/11, and that much of 9/11 was hatched in Hamburg, and that this is an issue, and clearly the Germans know that also. I've talked to many, high-level Germans who clearly are aware of that and understand that this was partly also a huge mistake on their part. And who knows? So, in fact, there's all kinds of levels. It's World War II. It's not being part of the big boys. It's seeing power differently. It's seeing the role of a state differently. It's seeing politics of states differently. So it's a multi-layered. It's a form of also, it's just being hurt. It's sort of it's an issue of trust or of again, I used the term infantilization before, which also kind of irks me. I think it's not by chance that the two most sort of outraged states about the Snowden affair have been Germany and Brazil. And these are precisely two states that are on the cusp of being very, very part of the big boys, but not quite yet. And to them, it's a form of, infantilization. It really, really hurts them. It's an issue of not being completely taken seriously, or also, and so that I think is very, very important. And whereas the Snowden thing in France or in Britain, whatever, was a great piece also in the New York Times op-ed on this, just fizzled. I mean, I think the Snowden affair to me is an American issue, not about the spying on other countries, which again is normal. That's what states do.
Well, in the case of what the German government did on Thursday, which is demand the expulsion of the top American spy official, the station chief there, apparently, again, there's evidence of arrogance on the American side. Apparently, Washington refused to cooperate with Germans.
I understand that you always... Yes, it is. I used the word arrogant before, but it's not only about... It's not always only about American arrogance, okay? That's not what is at issue here. It's also about understanding the context. So, yes, of course it's arrogant. I mean, so our guy was not immediately pulled back or something. But that's not the issue that you wanted to discuss is what about Germany did this, why this deep sensitivity? What this, people spy on each other. And I tried to explain to you that it really has something to do in this case more with Germany and its particular sensibilities towards the United States, towards all these other things, rather than how we in fact behaved here. That's not the issue. That's not what makes headlines. What makes headlines is that it really is something that in Germany tapping into a very sensitive thing. Okay.
Well, I think that's a very point well taken. You certainly made it. But clearly, though, when you have a situation where apparently Obama spends a lot of time on the phone with Putin, and then he also spends an awful lot of time on the phone with Angela Merkel, who understands Putin better than anybody. They both speak each other's language. And it's pretty clear to me that Ukraine is an extremely important issue at the moment, and you really need to be working closely with Germany on this. So what's your sense of whether...
Sure, absolutely. But there too, by the way, let's not forget that there might be a bit of a different angle here, okay? I forget the woman's name, very important American policymaker who used an expletive about...
Victoria Nuland, yeah.
There you go. You're better on this than I am. Clearly, there too are some rivalry dimensions where there is an issue, a bit of trust. Yes, Angela Merkel is, basically on the on President Obama's side, but German business sure as heck is not. Okay, and Angela Merkel is the chancellor of the CDU, which is a deeply anchored party in the business world, and the business world does not want to clamp down on Putin. Because Germany is far and away Russia's most important economic partner by many end degrees, much bigger than the United States. So Angela Merkel has to be very careful here, and it's unclear, by the way, how tough she wants to be on Putin. So again, the president is, yes, she is an ally, she is our friend, but not quite, or there are clearly issues of tension. But that's just the game of politics. I don't see this as aberrant or whatever. It's just Germany's geography is destiny. Germany is literally a couple of hundred miles away from the area. We are a lot further away. But this is a very sensitive issue, and I totally agree with you. But again, it's not quite clear that Germany is sort of one-to-one on the side of the United States on the issue of Putin and Ukraine. That's not the case. And certainly the German public isn't, and above all, much more importantly, German business isn't. And German business is absolutely gung-ho, not pro-Putin. No one likes Putin. But they don't want the boat rocked. They want to continue being the export Weltmeister. The only thing that might make them even more proud of being a world champion than being the export world champion is if, of course, they beat Argentina this Sunday. winning the export, the world championship. It's very important to Germany. Germany's business is absolutely paramount. Its export is paramount. It's an export-led economy, by the way, to the detriment of part of the rest of Europe. Germans should consume a lot more, and on and on and on. So it's just unclear whether, all I'm saying is that the relationship between President Obama and Angela Merkel, although on the whole congruent, it's not totally congruent. And this, by the way, has absolutely very little to do with the two people. This would be the case with any American president and any German chancellor, sure. But certainly a German chancellor of the CDU is even more beholden to business than obviously a social democratic chancellor would be.
Well, just in the last minute, Andre Markowitz, who do you think is going to win the World Cup?
Germany will.
And if you're a betting man, what would the point spread be?
Oh, the point spread? I mean, there's no point spread in soccer because there's so few goals. But,
exactly.
You mean in terms of the certainty? Or?
Yeah, in other words.
I would say, to me, Germany is a 3-1 or 4-1 favorite.
Well, we'll wait and see, and I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Andre Markowitz, who's the Karl W. Deutsch Collegiate Professor of Comparative Politics and German Studies at the University of Michigan. He has written on topics as varied as German and Austrian politics, anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, social democracy, social movements, the European right, and the European left. And his books include Uncouth Nation, Why Europe Dislikes America, Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism, and his latest book is Gaming the World, How Sports Are Reshaping Global Politics and Culture. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll go to El Salvador and speak with an activist scholar who assists Salvadorans fleeing from gang violence.
Fight like us, hey, what do you say? Someone took your plans away, so what's all of us? There ain't no
crops are all in, the peaches are rotting, the oranges are piled in their creosote dumps. They're flying you back to the Mexico border to pay all your money to wait back again. My father's own father, he waited that.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from El Salvador is Elizabeth Kennedy, who's an activist scholar who focuses on the experiences and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants. She recently published a report in the Journal of American Medical Association's Pediatrics about potential unmet mental health needs of detained unaccompanied child migrants and an article in Forced Migration Review about rejected Central American asylum claims of those fleeing gang-related violence. Working as a Fulbright Fellow with returned child and youth migrants from Mexico and the United States and El Salvador, she is currently assisting Salvadorans who are fleeing gang violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Kennedy.
Thank you very much for having me.
And where are most of these children coming from? I believe that of the about 58,000 who've arrived in the last few months, quite a number are coming from El Salvador and from a fairly few towns. Is that your understanding, there being on the ground?
Right. The majority of unaccompanied child migrants in the United States, over 90%, come from three Central American countries, so from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And within El Salvador, the three most common departments or states and cities are San Salvador, Usulután, and La Unión.
And in terms of the violence that they're fleeing from, what is the situation vis-a-vis street gangs? Of course, we are fairly aware of the MS-13 gang, which I believe was a prison gang that started here in the United States. But here in Southern California, quite a few members have been deported, but it seems like a revolving door. So is that an accurate picture of MS-13?
Right. So there are two main gangs here, and rather than being just simple local street gangs, they have fortified themselves so that they are now transnational criminal organizations capable of acting not only throughout each of these nations, but also throughout the region. Indeed, Mara Salvatrucha 13, MS-13, 13 and Barrio 18, so the 18th Street Gang, both began in the United States in southern Los Angeles. And they actually serve as a cautionary tale of why we should pay attention to child migrants and give them services. You know, many times unaccompanied child migrants arrive to poor neighborhoods in the United States that have very few services. Their parents or their family members are working a large number of jobs, and there's a lack of opportunities. You know, most of these kids are very motivated, very driven, and they manage to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, essentially. But a small number will eventually be targeted, will look for a sense of protection, an alternative sense of community, and that can be found in the gangs if they're not receiving alternative services. So in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, when many unaccompanied child migrants were arriving from these three nations because of their civil wars, we at that time did not give them any services. We did not pay attention to them. We did not treat them like refugees who had experienced trauma. And so you had a few who joined the gangs. And granted, it is the United States' responsibility that we began deporting these gang members just as Central American nations were signing peace accords. But at the same time, we have an opportunity to do things differently than we did in the past.
Well, I've talked to a number of scholars recently covering this issue, and many have said that we here in the United States bear a lot of responsibility for the instability in these countries, one, because of the extent to which the U.S. has supported military regimes, particularly murderous ones that were in El Salvador and in Guatemala. And then on top of that, others have said, well, the war on drugs is really a big part of the gang violence, and that is what's driving these children to seek refuge in the United States. And now on top of that, you have added a third layer, if you will, that we are even more directly responsible for the actual creation of these gangs themselves.
Definitely. You know, the thing about the United States that we often fail to consider is that our policies, whether they be domestic or international, have impacts for communities all around the world, and especially for Central America, with them being so close to us. You know, the thing we're seeing right now is that it is the country where many will choose to join, although the number who are going to Nicaragua, to Belize, to Mexico, other bordering nations are also increasing, especially those who are seeking asylum from these three countries. But in the same way, our policies have very severe effects on these nations. So with the Central American Free Trade Agreement that was signed, it has further contributed, well, in the time that it has signed, poverty has only gone up. In other Latin American nations, poverty has been decreasing, but in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, somehow it is still going up as agricultural jobs have diminished and have been paid less, which most people hear that's the service, the sector of the economy that they work in. Indeed, the United States did support military regimes here in the past. At the same time, we still invest the largest amount of money in, you know, war on drug policies and military and security solutions, which are problematic because it's been proven that many of these forces are corrupt and have a record of human rights abuses. Then indeed, we continue to deport gang members to these nations, even though we know that they are having a great battle trying to combat them right now. And then finally, we do not offer transnational families a way to go back and forth to visit each other. You know, many of these children have been separated from their parents for a decade or more. And I think a common misconception in the United States is that they could just get in line or get at the back of the line. Many Salvadorans that I've met applied for a visa and they were rejected, because such an important component of the application is the economic resources that you have. And in a nation where the average minimum wage is anywhere from $200 to $400 a month, you often cannot meet that bar that's required.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Kennedy, who's an activist scholar who focuses on the experiences and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants. She recently published a report in the Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics about potential unmet mental health needs of detained unaccompanied child migrants, and an article in Forced Migration Review about rejected Central American asylum claims for those fleeing gang-related violence. Working as a Fulbright Fellow with returned child and youth migrants from Mexico and the United States in El Salvador, she's currently assisting Salvadorans who are fleeing gang violence. So you're there in El Salvador, Elizabeth, and My understanding in terms of what the local Salvadoran leaders have done in terms of tactics to try and rein in the gangs began in, I think, 2003. There was a program known as Strong Hand, and that was then followed by Super Strong Hand, where they swept up thousands of these gang members into prison. But apparently this program only sort of went after the members of these gangs. They filled up the jails, but they didn't really go after the leaders or didn't capture the leaders. Is that a fair assessment?
It's definitely a fair assessment that these policies, which are based on zero tolerance policies that we had in New York and many of our cities throughout the United States, were intended to arrest, detain, and, you know, pacify, essentially, gang members. Now, the problem here is that these gangs are very powerful. They have a large amount of resources, just as cartels do in Mexico. So they have the capacity to pay off elected officials. They have the capacity to pay off police. They have the capacity to pay off military. So if one wants to be protected, like a leader, they will have the financial resources to ensure that that happens. The other issue is that these prisons are overflowing, and they are essentially operating grounds for the gangs. So this is true in Guatemala, in Honduras, and here in El Salvador. Oftentimes the prisons are at 300 or 400% capacity. I've met a number of families who have received extortion threats and death threats from within the prison. You know, the number comes up on their cell phone, is calling within the prison. The local press here, and by local I mean national media within the nation, have done a number of stories in which they showed that from each prison they have collected prohibited objects like iPhones, iPads, computer phones, chips, and different cell phones. So cell phone chips and cell phones that they are able to use within the gangs. And the gang leadership is actually in the prison a lot of the time. And there was some discussion a few months ago that even the gang's international leadership might have shifted here to El Salvador's prison.
So in 2012, the El Salvadoran government, along with the Organization of American States, apparently they brokered a truce between the leaders of these two main gangs that you mentioned. And what happened there? It clearly fell apart, right?
Well, you know, that's a more complicated story because in the United States, this brokered truce, supposed truce, received a lot of coverage, and I think people were quite hopeful that this could be the right approach to take since it involved working with the gangs, asking them what they needed in order to put down their arms. And the ideas that they suggested were actually not crazy. You know, they suggested being given economic opportunities, educational opportunities, social development opportunities that are often lacking from their communities. In the end, you know, I have yet to meet anyone in Central America that had confidence in that truce. So the reason that they will say they're unsure it ever existed is at the same time that the homicide numbers have, the number of extortions went up, the number of kidnappings went up, the number of disappearances went up. And then over the past year and a half, we've been finding all of these mass clandestine graves here. So some speculate that rather than the killing stopping, they just hid the bodies better. Now, to the extent that that truce ever existed, which we can argue back and forth, and Central Americans would be in a much better position to do that, it no longer exists. So in May, 401 people were killed in the nation of El Salvador, which is just had a population of just 6 million people. So that's an average of over 12 a day. In Honduras, they supposedly brokered the same type of truce. You never saw the dip in homicides, and the average daily is still 18 or 19 in a nation of just 8 million. So there's not a lot of evidence that these truces worked, which I do think is unfortunate because I think ultimately to have the gangs put down their arms, they will have to be involved and will essentially have to work with them to become community organizations instead of criminal organizations.
So tell me about the work that you do in terms of the children whose lives you try to protect. And many head north to the United States. There are, of course, reports here in the press that somehow there are billboards advertising, you know, El Dorado, where the streets are paved with gold. I don't hold much credence there. So two questions. What is the Underground Railroad in terms of encouraging people, which is what the conservatives in this country are arguing is going on. And they, in fact, are blaming Obama for encouraging this influx of immigrants.
Right. So I have to say, you know, I went to Guatemala for 10 days in October, Honduras for 10 days in October as well, and southern Mexico for 5 days in October. And then I've been here ever since, from November until now. I have yet to see any of these supposed billboards. I have yet to hear radio ads or to hear that a church is advertising that there's, you know, a gold paved road to the United States or a free ride. The thing is, many people here know the dangers of the journey. They know that they could be maimed, they could be raped, they could be robbed, that they could die, they could be forced into labor. And they're still taking the journey because they are so desperate. You know, some people have said coyotes or the smugglers are taking advantage of desperate people. That very well may be true, but at the end of the day, if they were not desperate, they would not be seeking out the coyotes or the smugglers. Now, I do ask the children about what they know about the United States, our laws, and why they decided to migrate now instead of a year or two ago, or, you know, wait another year or two. Only one of my first 400 interviews that took place before June 2nd did a child ask me specifically about DACA and the DREAM Act. He was a very special case because he was 15 years old and had already graduated from high school. He wants to be an engineer. Both of his parents have lived in the United States for longer than 10 years, and he has two U.S.-born siblings. So he had done his research online. He wanted to know if he'd be able to get a university degree because that's been his goal for the longest time. Besides him, no one could articulate the name of any specific U.S. legislation. 15 of the children and their families did ask me if the United States treats children differently than adults, and some of them had heard that we treated them more harshly, and others had heard that we treated them more leniently. And so that was a matter of explaining how the system was operating at that time. Now, part of my Fulbright has also involved giving presentations on child migrants in the United States to government officials, to NGOs, to just regular citizens, and for a time I was participating in the, what they call the prevention talk. So every time that a bus comes from Mexico, they do give a talk about the risk of the journeys, about how hard it is to live in the United States. And so I would present on the program that we had in the U.S. to receive child migrants, but also the difficulties involved with being an undocumented migrant without papers. And I can say from my own experience, prior to June 2nd, there was more or less widespread lack of knowledge at all. You know, to the extent that the population was invisible in the United States, here it wasn't even discussed. So.
So the bottom line is that we're getting so much disinformation. It's become a political football. People have lost sight of the humanitarian nature of it as a result. And just in closing, what's your final thoughts, Elizabeth?
I mean, I would go back to the fact that these are very motivated and talented children and youth, and they are people who are going to be the future of whichever nation receives them. So whether they're in the United States or they're here in countries of origin, we need to invest in them because they want a better future, they want a better life, and they want it for themselves, their family, their friends. So to me, I think it is worth a minimal front-end investment to allow them to make that happen. At the same time, I would like to emphasize the humanitarian piece. These are children. These are brothers and sisters. These are sons and daughters. These are cousins. These are friends. And many of them have family members and friends who are United States citizens. This is not a case where we can say they're not our own. They are our own. And they ought to have the opportunity to arrive safely to a place where they can be protected and grow old and get the skill set that they'd like to be able to give back to their communities.
Well, Elizabeth Kennedy, I thank you so much for joining us from El Salvador.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Kennedy, who's an activist scholar who focuses on the experience and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants. She recently published a report in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Pediatrics, about potential unmet mental health needs of detained unaccompanied child migrants, and has an article in Forced Migration Review about rejected Central American asylum claims of those fleeing gang-related violence. Working as a Fulbright Fellow with the returned child and youth migrants from Mexico and the United States in El Salvador, she's currently assisting Salvadorans who are fleeing gang violence. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back getting a statistical analysis that shows that violence, not deferred action, is behind the surge of unaccompanied children crossing the border.
Land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Wong, who is a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, whose research focuses on the politics of immigration, citizenship, and migrant illegality. He is the creator of the 2013 Center for Investigative Reporting blog, which predicts support and opposition to comprehensive immigration reform among all the current members of Congress, and is the lead researcher on one of the first nationwide surveys of undocumented youth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Wong.
Thank you for having me.
And it's pretty clear that, well, it's certainly clear to me that there's a bit of an anomaly here, that these children that are flooding the border, I believe something like 58,000 so far, are coming from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, but they're not coming from Costa Rica, Panama, and Nicaragua. And there's clearly got to be reasons for that. So let's begin with the murder rate comparison.
Yes, so what I did in my recent research is take a look at the drivers of unaccompanied children coming to the U.S. over the past few years. And so one of the main arguments that are being made is that violence in the home countries of these young people are what's driving these, driving the trend in the increase in unaccompanied minors. And so what the data show is that that indeed is one of the main drivers. So when we think about the countries that are at the core of the current controversy over unaccompanied minors, they're El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And those countries are experiencing very high levels of violence, as indicated by their annual homicide rates, and we get these data from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. And when we include all other Latin American countries in the analysis, in other words, when we include countries that are experiencing violence and aren't experiencing violence, then what we see is a clear trend. The countries that are experiencing violence are the ones that are sending the most unaccompanied minors to the U.S. The countries that aren't experiencing violence, well, we don't see unaccompanied minors from those countries at similar rates.
So specifically then, the murder rate in, and this is a 2012 statistic that's in your article, statistical analysis shows that violence, not deferred action, is behind the surge of unaccompanied children crossing the border. In 2012, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras have a murder rate of 54 per 100,000 people. And then you contrast that to, say, Nicaragua, that has only 13 per 100,000. And by the way, Nicaragua is the second poorest country in the region, only behind Haiti. So when people make the analogies between poverty and economic deprivation and violence, that doesn't pan out, does it?
Well, so what I was able to do in the analysis is not only look at violence, but also look at economic conditions in sending countries and other factors like geographic distance from the capital of these countries to the United States. And so even when we account for these other factors, violence remains a significant driver. This is not to say that geography or economic conditions do not matter. In fact, they do. But what we see is that violence is systematically related to the flow of unaccompanied minors to the United States.
So, Tom Wong, then why is it then that obviously this situation has even though many see it as a humanitarian crisis. Apparently that is not stopping in this election year from it becoming a political football. And I guess it's your representative, right? Representative Daryl Issa has been going after President Obama, trying to get him to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the DACA program of 2012, which grants eligible unauthorized youth a two-year reprieve from deportation and a work permit. And clearly that's an example of how politics have got in there. But who is able to reach people like the governor of Texas and Representative Daryl Issa to explain what you have shown in your study, that violence, not deferred action, is behind this surge of unaccompanied children crossing the border?
Well, I think you make a very important point. This is a very real and significant humanitarian issue, but one that has turned into political theater where certain individuals are scoring political points. Daryl Issa in particular has called for not only an end to DACA, but also for the renewed deportation of those who have received DACA status. Now, the argument that folks like Daryl Issa make is that DACA is incentivizing the flow of unaccompanied minors to the United States. Now, what I tried to do in the article is take that argument seriously and see if the data support it. And the data do not support it. So there are a couple of things in particular. One, putting aside the actual requirements for DACA, which means that those newly arrived unaccompanied minors do not even qualify, we actually see that the increase in unaccompanied minors started well before DACA even began. And so that's one thing that sort of we can look at to say, well, you know, DACA may not be what's driving the increase in unaccompanied minors. Now, if DACA were causally related to the increase in unaccompanied minors, it also stands to reason that undocumented young people from all parts of the world, including other parts of Central America and South America, would be equally incentivized. What that means is that the national origins profile of these unaccompanied minors should be as diverse as the documented population itself. But that's not true. What we see is that the increase in unaccompanied minors, again, is being driven by three countries in particular, and these three countries are experiencing increasing levels of violence. So here, the data simply do not support the claim that DACA is causally related to the increase in unaccompanied minors, which makes the political argument disingenuous that DACA is the cause and therefore DACA should be repealed. Now, to the question of, you know, who can reach and influence individuals like Daryl Issa to, for lack of a better expression, see the light, I don't have an answer for that, because it seems like some of these arguments, again, it's a political football, as you described, and some representatives have found this issue as one where they can score political points, and seemingly irrespective of the reality of what the data actually show.
And again, I'm speaking with Tom Wong, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, whose research focuses on the politics of immigration, citizenship, and migrant illegality. He is the creator of the 2013 Center for Investigative Reporting blog, which predicts support and opposition to comprehensive immigration reform among all current members of Congress, and is the lead researcher on one of the first nationwide surveys of undocumented youth. So the other refrain, though, that we're hearing, particularly from the political right, with Senator Ted Cruz and along with Daryl Issa and others, and of course the governor of Texas who met with the president on Wednesday and castigated him, at least not necessarily in person, but in the press, for not going down to the border, to which Obama had to say, well, you know, I'm getting good information. I'm not interested in photo ops. I'm interested in solving the problem. But they always use this refrain that we need to beef up the Border Patrol. And, I mean, the Border Patrol cannot be more beefed up. Under the Obama administration, funding for the Border Patrol has reached record levels, increasing from $2.3 billion at the end of the Bush administration in 2008 to $3.5 billion for fiscal year 2013, an increase of 52%. So what are they talking about? I know Governor Perry wants to send the National Guard or the U.S. military on top of that, but it sounds like there's just no more money that the Border Patrol can spend.
Yeah, so this is another argument that I took on in my recent analysis. And so the argument is that lax border security is one of the drivers of the increase in unaccompanied minors. And so if we look at the data, we would expect that different indicators of border security, like you mentioned, budgets, or maybe even Border Patrol agent staffing, well, those may have decreased over time while unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. increased during that same period. That's what we would expect if that argument that lax border security is driving the increase in unaccompanied minors. That's what we would expect if that argument were true. But looking at the data, we see the exact opposite. As you mentioned, not only has the budget CBP increased over time, reaching, again, as you mentioned, record levels, but we see Border Patrol agent staffing also increased to record levels under the Obama administration. And we can actually disaggregate the total number of Border Patrol agents at all parts of the border and also focus on the number of Border Patrol agents along the southwest border, where there's the most activity when it comes to unaccompanied minors. And via all these metrics, we see record levels of border enforcement. And so what I argue here is that, well, the data do not support the argument that lax border security is one of the drivers of the current increase in unaccompanied minors, that the increase in unaccompanied minors is actually occurring in spite of record levels of border security.
So, again, are we dealing in an environment where facts don't matter? Is that the problem here, that we are in an election year? Because it'd be nice to focus on the actual problem, and I think more importantly, on these children. I mean, they're not really old enough to be held totally responsible for the situation they're in, and one would think that normal human decency would afford them a little latitude.
Absolutely. One would hope and expect that, but the truism is that objective facts can be interpreted by two people differently, and that sometimes is the crux of partisan political debates and divides. When it comes to the border security argument specifically, and as you mentioned, Governor Perry's request to send the National Guard to the border to address this issue, it is important to note that not only are there record numbers of Border Patrol agents along the southwest border, but the issue isn't one of unaccompanied minors trying to sneak in between ports of entry. And so this is not a law enforcement apprehension type of dynamic. These unaccompanied minors are surrendering themselves at different ports of entry. In other words, there is no chase. They are simply saying, I am here, and to request more Border Patrol agents or National Guard to be sent to the border to monitor the places in between ports of entry completely misses the reality of what is happening, and that these unaccompanied minors, for the large part, are simply surrendering themselves at ports of entry.
Well, I think more to the point, they're actually looking for somebody to surrender to, aren't they, and give them some water. But that's a very good point, Thomas Wong. So just to wrap up here then, what's your sense of whether or not there will be an honest debate at any point? I mean, obviously, let's forget about, and I know you'd done a study on, or you do a study on how the Congress would vote for comprehensive immigration reform. That is as dead as a dodo, isn't it? Particularly after Eric Cantor got bumped off by a Tea Party candidate that's got all of the Republicans running to the hills on immigration. So what's your sense then of whether it's just, you know, there's something that can break this logjam of ideological rigidity?
Well, I think President Obama is headed in the right direction in addressing this issue. And one of the sort of core recommendations that he's made in his budget request is to increase monies for immigration judges to help adjudicate these new cases of unaccompanied minors and sometimes families. This is something that is seemingly a common sense move, that There are more unaccompanied minors, so there are more cases that need to be heard, and more immigration judges need to hear those cases in order to adjudicate them, so that either those who have legitimate claims to asylum are victims of human trafficking can find safe haven, and those who aren't can be returned to their country of origin if that can be done in a safe manner. This is one way that we can address the problem, but we already hear rankling within Congress that President Obama's budget request is going to meet some pretty stiff opposition. I'll also add that one of the sort of next legislative fights within this broader context of unaccompanied minors is going to be over the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. This is something that we have heard in a recent congressional hearing as another potential driver of unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. And so this is a 2008, under the Bush administration, law that does a few things that are germane to the current dynamics. So one, it allowed the U.S. to negotiate a special repatriation agreement with Mexico so that unaccompanied Mexican minors could be returned to Mexico expeditiously. Now, what it also did was say that for all other unaccompanied minors from non-contiguous countries, so that's all of Central America and South America, as well as the rest of the world, unaccompanied minors who come to our borders should be afforded a couple of things in particular. One is safe and secure conditions. And so this is where we see unaccompanied minors being given to the Department of Health and Human Services so that they can be cared for. And we also see that there is a recommendation for legal counsel for unaccompanied minors in immigration court. So in essence, what the TVPRA does is say unaccompanied minors from places like El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, again, those countries that are at the core of this current increase, these unaccompanied minors should be afforded basic due process protections. And some have argued that these basic due process protections are actually incentivizing more unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. And again, the data do not support that argument. But that, it looks like, is the next legislative battle in Congress when it comes to this issue.
Well, Tom Wong, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Wong, who is a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, whose research focuses on the politics of immigration, citizenship, and migrant illegality. He is the creator of the 2013 Center for Investigative Reporting blog, which predicts support and opposition to comprehensive immigration reform among all current members of Congress, and is the lead researcher on one of the first nationwide surveys of undocumented youth. His article, Statistic Analysis, shows that violence, not deferred action, is behind the surge of unaccompanied children crossing the border, is available at the Center for American Progress's website. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also scroll down on the right-hand side and subscribe to iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.